You'd never betray us, would you, Roland?
No man can say that for sure, Eddie. And I have already played the betrayer more than once, to my shame. But I think those days are over. We are one. Quartet. If I betray any one of you, even Jake's furry friend, perhaps, I betray myself. Why do you ask?
And you'd never betray your quest.
Renounce the tower? No, Eddie. Not that. Not ever. Tell me your dream.
Eddie did, omitting nothing.
When he had finished, Roland looked down at his guns, frowning. They seemed to have reassembled themselves while Eddie was talking.
So what does it mean that I saw you driving that dozer at the end? That I still don't trust you?
That subconsciously is this ology of the psyche, the Kabbalah I have heard you and Susanna speak of?
Yes, I guess it is.
It's shit, Roland said dismissively. Mud pies of the mind. Dreams either mean nothing or everything, and when they mean everything, they almost always come as messages from, well, from other levels of the tower. He gazed at Eddie shrewdly. And not all messages are sent by friends.
Something or someone is fucking with my head, is that what you mean?
I think it possible. But you must watch me, all the same. I bear watching, as you well know.
I trust you, Eddie said,
and the very awkwardness with which he spoke lent his words sincerity. Roland looked touched, almost shaken, and Eddie wondered how he ever could have thought this man an emotionless robot. Roland might be a little short on imagination, but he had feelings all right.
One thing about your dream concerns me very much, Eddie.
The bulldozer? The machine, yes. The threat to the rose.
Jake saw the rose, Roland. It was fine.
Roland nodded. In his when, the when of that particular day, the rose was thriving. But that doesn't mean it will continue to do so. If the construction the sign spoke of comes, if the bulldozer comes...
There are other worlds than these, Eddie said, remember?
Some things may exist only in one. In one where, in one when. Roland lay down and looked up at the stars. We must protect that rose, he said. We must protect it at all costs.
You think it's another door, don't you? One that opens on the Dark Tower.
The gunslinger looked at him from eyes that ran with starshine. I think it may be the tower, he said. And if it's destroyed... His eyes closed. He said no more. Eddie lay awake late. 11. The new day dawned clear and bright and cold. In the strong morning sunlight, the thing Eddie had spotted the evening before was more clearly visible, but he still couldn't tell what it was. Another riddle, and he was getting damn sick of them. He stood squinting at it, shading his eyes from the sun, with Susanna on one side of him and Jake on the other. Roland was back by the campfire, packing what he called their gunna, a word which seemed to mean all their worldly goods. He appeared not to be concerned with the thing up ahead, or to know what it was. How far away? 30 miles? 50? The answer seemed to depend on how far you could see in all this flat land, and Eddie didn't know the answer. One thing he felt quite sure of was that Jake had been right on at least 2 counts. It was some kind of building, and it sprawled all across 4 lanes of the highway. It must. How else could they see it? It would have been lost in the thinny. Wouldn't it? Maybe it's standing in one of those open patches, what Suze calls the holes in the clouds. Or maybe the thinny ends before we get that far. Or maybe it's a goddamn hallucination. In any case, you might as well put it out of your mind for the time being. Got a little more turnpiking to do. Still, the building held him. It looked like an airy Arabian Nights confection of blue and gold. Except Eddie had an idea that the blue was stolen from the sky, and the gold from the newly risen sun.
"Roland, come here a second."
At first he didn't think the gunslinger would, But then Roland cinched a rawhide lace on Susanna's pack, rose, put his hands in the small of his back, stretched, and walked over to them.
"Gods, one would think no one in this band had the wit to housekeep but me," Roland said.
"We'll pitch in," Eddie said. "We always do, don't we? But look at that thing first."
Roland did, but only with a quick glance, as if he did not even want to acknowledge it.
"It's glass, isn't it?" Eddie asked.
Roland took another brief look. "I want," he said, a phrase which seemed to mean "reckon so, partner."
"We've got lots of glass buildings where I come from, but most of them are office buildings. That thing up ahead looks more like something from Disney World. Do you know what it is?"
"No."
"Then why don't you want to look at it?" Susanna asked.
Roland did take another look at the distant blaze of light on glass, but once again it was quick, little more than a peek.
"Because it's trouble," Roland said, "and it's in our road. We'll get there in time. No need to live in trouble until trouble comes."
"Will we get there today?" Jake asked. Roland shrugged, his face still closed. "There'll be water if God wills it," he said.
"Christ, you could have made a fortune writing fortune cookies," Eddie said.
He hoped for a smile, at least, but got none. Roland simply walked back across the road, dropped to one knee, shouldered his purse and his pack, and waited for the others. When they were ready, the pilgrims resumed their walk east along Interstate 70. The gunslinger led, walking with his head down and his eyes on the toes of his boots.
12. Roland was quiet all day, and as the building ahead of them neared, trouble, and in our road, he had said, Susanna came to realize it wasn't grumpiness they were seeing, or worry about anything which lay any farther ahead of them than tonight. It was the story he'd promised to tell them that Roland was thinking about, and he was a lot more than worried. By the time they stopped for their noon meal, they could clearly see the building ahead, a many-turreted palace which appeared to be made entirely of reflective glass. The thinny lay close around it, but the palace rose serenely above all, its turrets trying for the sky. Madly strange, here in the flat countryside of eastern Kansas, of course it was, but Susanna thought it the most beautiful building she had ever seen in her life, even more beautiful than the Chrysler Building, and that was going some. As they drew closer, she found it more and more difficult to look elsewhere. Watching the reflections of the puffy clouds sailing across the glass castle's blue sky wanes and walls was like watching some splendid illusion. Yet there was a solidity to it as well, an inarguability. Some of that was probably just the shadow it threw. Mirages did not, so far as she knew, create shadows. But not all. It just was. She had no idea what such a fabulosity was doing out here in the land of Stuckey's and Hardee's, not to mention Boing Boing Burgers. But there it was. She reckoned that time would tell the rest. 13. They made camp in silence, watched Roland build the wooden chimney that would be their fire in silence, then sat before it in silence, watching the sunset turn the huge glass edifice ahead of them into a castle of fire. Its towers and battlements glowed first a fierce red, then orange, then a gold, which cooled rapidly to ochre as Old Star appeared in the firmament above them.
"No," she thought in Detta's voice, "ain't that one, girl, not at all. That's the North Star, same one you seen back home sitting on your daddy's lap."
But it was Old Star she wanted, she discovered, Old Star and Old Mother. She was astounded to find herself homesick for Roland's world, and then wondered why she should be so surprised. It was a world, after all, where no one had called her a nigger bitch, at least not yet. A world where she had found someone to love, and made good friends as well. That last made her feel a little bit like crying, and she hugged Jake to her. He let himself be hugged, smiling, his eyes half closed. At some distance, unpleasant but bearable, even without bullet earplugs, the thinny warbled its moaning song. When the last traces of yellow began to fade from the castle up the road, Roland left them to sit in the turnpike travel lane and returned to his fire. He cooked more leaf-wrapped deer meat and handed the food around. They ate in silence. Roland actually ate almost nothing, Susanna observed. By the time they were finished, they could see the Milky Way scattered across the walls of the castle ahead of them, fierce points of reflection that burned like fire in still water. Eddie was the one who finally broke the silence.
"You don't have to," he said. "You're excused, or absolved, or whatever the hell it is you need to take that look off your face."
Roland ignored him. He drank, tilting the water skin up on his elbow like some hick drinking moonshine from a jug, head back, eyes on the stars. The last mouthful he spat to the roadside.
"Life for your crop," Eddie said. He did not smile.
Roland said nothing, but his cheek went pale, as if he had seen a ghost or heard one. 14. The gunslinger turned to Jake, who looked back at him seriously. "I went through the trial of manhood at the age of 14, the youngest of my cartel, of my class, you would say, and perhaps the youngest ever. I told you some of that, Jake, do you remember?"
"You told all of us some of that," Susanna thought, but kept her mouth shut and warned Eddie with her eyes to do the same.
Roland hadn't been himself during that telling. With Jake both dead and alive within his head, the man had been fighting madness.
"You mean when we were chasing Walter," Jake said, "after the way station, but before I took my fall."
"That's right."
"I remember a little, but that's all. The way you remember the stuff you dream about."
Roland nodded. "Listen, then. I would tell you more this time, Jake, because you are older. I suppose we all are."
Susanna was no less fascinated with the story the second time, how the boy Roland had chanced to discover Martin, his father's advisor, his father's wizard, in his mother's apartment. Only none of it had been by chance, of course. The boy would have passed the door with no more than a glance had Martin not opened it and invited him in. Martin had told Roland that his mother wanted to see him. But one look at her rueful smile and downcast eyes as she sat in her low-back chair told the boy he was the last person in the world Gabrielle Duchesne wanted to see just then. The flush on her cheek and the love bite on the side of her neck told him everything else. Thus had he been goaded by Martin into an early trial of manhood, and by employing a weapon his teacher had not expected, his hawk, David, Roland had defeated Court, taken his stick, and made the enemy of his life in Martin Broadcloak. Beaten badly, face swelling into something that looked like a child's goblin mask, slipping toward a coma, Court had fought back unconsciousness long enough to offer his newest apprentice gunslinger counsel. "Stay away from Martin yet a while," Court had said. "He told me to let the story of our battle grow into a legend," the gunslinger told Eddie, Susanna, and Jake. "To wait until my shadow had grown hair on its face and haunted Martin in his dreams."
"Did you take his advice?" Susanna asked. "I never got a chance," Roland said. His face cracked in a rueful, painful smile. "I meant to think about it, and seriously. But before I even got started on my thinking, things changed."
"They have a way of doing that, don't they?" Eddie said. "My goodness, yes.
I buried my hawk, the first weapon I ever wielded, and perhaps the finest. Then, and this part I'm sure I didn't tell you before, Jake, I went into the lower town. That summer's heat broke in storms full of thunder and hail, and in a room above one of the brothels where Court had been wont to roister, I lay with a woman for the first time." He poked a stick thoughtfully into the fire, seemed to become aware of the unconscious symbolism in what he was doing, and threw it away with a lopsided grin. It landed, smoldering, near the tire of an abandoned Dodge Aspen, and went out. It was good. The sex was good. Not the great thing I and my friends had thought about and whispered about and wondered about, of course.
"I think store-bought pussy tends to be overrated by the young, sugar," Susanna said.
I fell asleep listening to the sots downstairs singing along with the piano and to the sound of hail on the window. I awoke the next morning in, well, let's just say I awoke in a way I never would have expected to awake in such a place.
Jake fed fresh fuel to the fire. It flared up, painting highlights on Roland's cheeks, brushing crescents of shadow beneath his brows and below his lower lip. And as he talked, Susanna found she could almost see what had happened on that long-ago morning that must have smelled of wet cobblestones and rain-sweetened summer air. What had happened in a whore's crib above a drinking dive in the lower town of Gilead, barony seat of New Canaan, one small mote of land located in the western regions of Mid-World. One boy, still aching from his battle of the day before and newly educated in the mysteries of sex. One boy, now looking 12 instead of 14, his lashes dusting down thick upon his cheeks, the lids shuttering those extraordinary blue eyes. One boy with his hand loosely cupping a whore's breast, his hawk-scarred wrist lying tanned upon the counterpane. One boy in the final instance of his life's last good sleep. One boy who will shortly be in motion, who will be falling as a dislodged pebble falls on a steep and broken slope of scree. A falling pebble that strikes another, and another, and another, those pebbles striking yet more, until the whole slope is in motion and the earth shakes with the sound of the landslide. One boy, one pebble on a slope loose and ready to slide. A knot exploded in the fire. Somewhere in this dream of Kansas, an animal yipped. Susanna watched sparks swirl up past Roland's incredibly ancient face and saw in that face the sleeping boy of a summer's morn lying in a bawd's bed. And then she saw the door crash open, ending Gilead's last troubled dream.
15. The man who strode in, crossing the room to the bed before Roland could open his eyes, and before the woman beside him had even begun to register the sound, was tall, slim, dressed in faded jeans and a dusty shirt of blue chambray. On his head was a dark gray hat with a snakeskin band. Lying low on his hips were two old leather holsters. Jutting from them were the sandalwood grips of the pistols the boy would someday bear to lands of which this scowling man with the furious blue eyes would never dream. Roland was in motion even before he was able to unseal his eyes, rolling to the left, groping beneath the bed for what was there. He was fast, so fast it was scary, but, and Susanna saw this too, saw it clearly, the man in the faded jeans was faster yet. He grabbed the boy's shoulder and yanked, turning him naked out of bed and onto the floor. The boy sprawled there, reaching again for what was beneath the bed, lightning quick. The man in the jeans stamped down on his fingers before they could grasp.
"Bastard!" the boy gasped. "Oh, you bast—"
But now his eyes were open. He looked up and saw that the invading bastard was his father. The whore was sitting up now, her eyes puffy, her face slack and petulant.
"Here," she cried, "here, here. You can't just be a-comin' in like that, so you can't. Why, if I was to raise my voice—"
Ignoring her, the man reached beneath the bed and dragged out two gun belts. Near the end of each was a holstered revolver. They were large and amazing in this largely gunless world, but they were not so large as those worn by Roland's father, and the grips were eroded metal plates rather than inlaid wood. When the whore saw the guns on the invader's hips, and the ones in his hands, the ones her young customer of the night before had been wearing, until she had taken him upstairs and divested him of all weapons save for the one with which she was most familiar, the expression of sleepy petulance left her face. What replaced it was the fox-like look of a born survivor. She was up, out of bed, across the floor, and out the door before her bare bum had more than a brief moment to twinkle in the morning sun. Neither the father standing by the bed nor the son lying naked upon the floor at his feet so much as looked at her. The man in the jeans held out the gun belts, which Roland had taken from the fuser beneath the apprentice's barracks on the previous afternoon, using Court's key to open the arsenal door. The man shook the belts under Roland's very nose, as one might hold a torn garment beneath the nose of a feckless puppy that has chewed. He shook them so hard that one of the guns tumbled free. Despite his stupefaction, Roland caught it in mid-air.
"I thought you were in the West," Roland said, "in Cressia."
After Farson and his Roland's father slapped him, hard enough to send the boy tumbling across the room and into a corner with blood pouring from one corner of his mouth. Roland's first appalling instinct was to raise the gun he still held. Stephen Deschain looked at him, hands on hips, reading this thought even before it was fully formed. His lips pulled back in a singularly mirthless grin, one that showed all of his teeth and most of his gums.
"Shoot me if you will."
"Why not? Make this abortion complete. Ah, gods, I'd welcome it."
Roland laid the gun on the floor and pushed it away, using the back of his hand to do it. All at once he wanted his fingers nowhere near the trigger of a gun. They were no longer fully under his control, those fingers. He had discovered that yesterday, right around the time he had broken Court's nose.
"Father, I was tested yesterday. I took Court's stick. I won. I'm a man."
"You're a fool," his father said.
His grin was gone now. He looked haggard and old. He sat down heavily on the whore's bed, looked at the gun belts he still held, and dropped them between his feet. "You're a 14-year-old fool, and that's the worst, most desperate kind." He looked up, angry all over again, but Roland didn't mind. Anger was better than that look of weariness, that look of age.
"I've known since you toddled that you were no genius, but I never believed until yestereve that you were an idiot. To let him drive you like a cow in a chute, gods! You have forgotten the face of your father, say it!"
And that sparked the boy's own anger. Everything he had done the day before, he had done with his father's face firmly fixed in his mind.
"That's not true!"
he shouted from where he now sat, with his bare butt on the splintery boards of the whore's crib and his back against the wall, the sun shining through the window and touching the fuzz on his fair, unscarred cheek.
"It is true, you whelp! Foolish whelp! Say your atonement, or I'll strip the hide from your very— They were together!"
he burst out.
"Your wife and your minister, your magician, I saw the mark of his mouth on her neck, on my mother's neck!"
He reached for the gun and picked it up, but even in his shame and fury was still careful not to let his fingers stray near the trigger. He held the apprentice's revolver only by the plain, undecorated metal of its barrel.
"Today I end his treacherous seducer's life with this, and if you aren't man enough to help me, at least you can stand aside and let me—"
One of the revolvers on Stephen's hip was out of its holster and in his hand before Roland's eyes saw any move. There was a single shot, deafening as thunder, in the little room. It was a full minute before Roland was able to hear the babble of questions and commotion from below. The prentice gun, meanwhile, was long gone, blown out of his hand and leaving nothing behind but a kind of buzzing tingle. It flew out the window, down and gone, its grip a smashed ruin of metal, and its short turn in the gunslinger's long tail at an end. Roland looked at his father, shocked and amazed. Stephen looked back, saying nothing for a long time. But now he wore the face Roland remembered from earliest childhood, calm and sure. The weariness and the look of half-distracted fury had passed away like last night's thunderstorms. At last his father spoke.
"I was wrong in what I said, and I apologize. You did not forget my face, Roland. But still you were foolish. You allowed yourself to be driven by one far slyer than you will ever be in your life. It's only by the grace of the gods and the working of Kaa that you have not been sent west, one more true gunslinger out of Martin's Road, out of John Farson's Road, and out of the road which leads to the creature that rules them." He stood and held out his arms. "If I had lost you, Roland, I should have died." Roland got to his feet and went naked to his father, who embraced him fiercely. When Stephen Deschain kissed him first on one cheek and then the other, Roland began to weep. Then, in Roland's ear,
Stephen Duchesne whispered 6 words. "16."
"What?"
Susanna asked. "What 6 words?"
"I have known for 2 years," Roland said. That was what he whispered.
"Holy Christ," Eddie said.
"He told me I couldn't go back to the palace. If I did, I'd be dead by nightfall. He said you have been born to your destiny in spite of all Martin could do, yet he has sworn to kill you before you can grow to be a problem to him. It seems that, winner in the test or no, you must leave Gilead anyway. For only a while, though, and you'll go east instead of west. I'd not send you alone, either, or without a purpose." Then, almost as an afterthought, he added, "or with a pair of sorry prentice revolvers."
"What purpose?" Jake asked. He had clearly been captivated by the story. His eyes shone nearly as bright as Oi's. "And which friends?"
"These things you must now hear," Roland said. "And how you judge me will come in time." He fetched a sigh, the deep sigh of a man who contemplates some arduous piece of work, and then tossed fresh wood on the fire. As the flames flared up, driving the shadows back a little way, he began to talk. All that queerly long night he talked, not finishing the story of Susan Delgado until the sun was rising in the east and painting the glass castle yonder with all the bright hues of a fresh day, and a strange green cast of light, which was its own true color.
Part 2. Susan. Chapter 1. Beneath the Kissing Moon. 1. A perfect disk of silver, the Kissing Moon, as it was called, in full earth, hung above the ragged hill 5 miles east of Hambry and 10 miles south of Eyebolt Canyon. Below the hill, the late summer heat still held, suffocating even 2 hours after sundown, but atop the coos, it was as if REAP had already come, with its strong breezes and frost-pinched air. For the woman who lived here, with no company but a snake and one old mutey cat, it was to be a long night.
"Never mind, though. Never mind, my dear. Busy hands are happy hands, so they are."
She waited until the hoofbeats of her visitors' horses had faded, sitting quietly by the window in the hut's large room. There was only one other, a bedroom, little bigger than a closet. Musty, the 6-legged cat, was on her shoulder. Her lap was full of moonlight. 3 horses bearing away 3 men. The big coffin hunters, they called themselves. She snorted. Men were funny. Aye, so they were, and the most amusing thing about them was how little they knew it. Men, with their swaggering, belt-hitching names for themselves. Men so proud of their muscles, their drinking capacities, their eating capacities, so everlastingly proud of their pricks. Yes, even in these times, when a good many of them could shoot nothing but strange, bent seed that produced children fit only to be drowned in the nearest well. Ah, but it was never their fault, was it, dear? No, always it was the woman, her womb, her fault. Men were such cowards, such grinning cowards. These 3 had been no different from the general run. The old one with the limp might bear watching, aye, so he might. A clear and overly curious pair of eyes had looked out at her from his head. But she saw nothing in them she could not deal with, came it to that. Men. She could not understand why so many women feared them. Hadn't the gods made them with the most vulnerable part of their guts hanging right out of their bodies like a misplaced bit of bowel? Kicked them there and they curled up like snails. Caressed them there and their brains melted. Anyone who doubted that second bit of wisdom need only look at her night's second bit of business, the one which still lay ahead. Thorin, mayor of Hambry, chief guard of Barony, no fool like an old fool. Yet none of these thoughts had any real power over her, or any real malice to them, at least not now. The three men who called themselves the Big Coffin Hunters had brought her a marvel, and she would look at it, aye, fill up her eyes with it, so she would. The gimp, Jonas, had insisted she put it away. He had been told she had a place for such things, not that he wanted to see it himself, not any of her secret places, gods forbid. At this sally, DePape and Reynolds had laughed like trolls. And so she had. But the hoofbeats of their horses had been swallowed by the wind now, and she would do as she liked. The girl whose tits had stolen what little there was of Hart Thorin's mind would not be here for another hour at least. The old woman had insisted that the girl walk from town, citing the purification value of such a moonlit heel and toe, actually just wanting to put a safe bumper of time between her two appointments, and during that hour she would do as she liked.
"Oh, it's beautiful, I'm sure it is," she whispered.
And did she feel a certain heat in that place where her ancient bow legs came together, a certain moisture in the dry creek which hid there? Gods!
Ah, even through the box where they hid it, I felt its glam. So beautiful, Musty, like you.
She took the cat from her shoulder and held it in front of her eyes. The old Tom purred and stretched out its pug of a face toward hers. She kissed its nose. The cat closed its milky gray-green eyes in ecstasy.
So beautiful, like you. So you are, he.
She put the cat down. It walked slowly toward the hearth, where a late fire lazed, desultorily eating at a single log. Musty's tail split at the tip so it looked like the forked tail of a devil in an old drawing switched back and forth in the room's dim orange air. Its extra legs, dangling from its sides, twitched dreamily. The shadow which trailed across the floor and grew up the wall was a horror, a thing that looked like a cat crossed with a spider. The old woman rose and went into her sleeping closet, where she had taken the thing Jonas had given her.
"Lose that, and you'll lose your head," he'd said. "Never fear me, my good friend," she'd replied, directing a cringing, servile smile back over her shoulder, all the while thinking men, foolish, strutting creatures they were.
Now she went to the foot of her bed, knelt, and passed one hand over the earth floor there. Lines appeared in the soured dirt as she did. They formed a square. She pushed her fingers into one of these lines. It gave before her touch. She lifted the hidden panel, hidden in such a way that no one without the touch would ever be able to uncover it, revealing a compartment perhaps a foot square and 2 feet deep. Within it was an ironwood box. Curled atop the box was a slim green snake. When she touched its back, its head came up. Its mouth yawned in a silent hiss, displaying 4 pairs of fangs, 2 on top, 2 on the bottom. She took the snake up, crooning to it. As she brought its flat face close to her own, its mouth yawned wider, and its hissing became audible. She opened her own mouth. From between her wrinkled gray lips, she poked the yellowish, bad-smelling mat of her tongue. 2 drops of poison, enough to kill an entire dinner party if mixed in the punch, fell on it. She swallowed, feeling her mouth and throat and chest burn, as if with strong liquor. For a moment the room swam out of focus, and she could hear voices murmuring in the stenchy air of the hut, the voices of those she called the unseen friends. Her eyes ran sticky water down the trenches time had drawn in her cheeks. Then she blew out a breath, and the room steadied. The voices faded. She kissed Ermit between his lidless eyes. "Time of the kissin' moon, all right," she thought, and then set him aside. The snake slipped beneath her bed, curled itself in a circle, and watched as she passed her palms over the top of the ironwood box. She could feel the muscles in her upper arms quivering, and that heat in her loins was more pronounced. Years it had been since she had felt the call of her sex, but she felt it now, so she did, and it was not the doing of the kissing moon, or not much. The box was locked, and Jonas had given her no key, but that was nothing to her, who had lived long and studied much and trafficked with creatures that most men, for all their bold talk and strutting ways, would run from as if on fire had they caught even the smallest glimpse of them. She stretched one hand toward the lock, on which was inlaid the shape of an eye, and a motto in the high speech, "I see who opens me," and then withdrew it. All at once she could smell what her nose no longer noticed under ordinary circumstances, must and dust and a dirty mattress and the crumbs of food that had been consumed in bed, the mingled stench of ashes and ancient incense, the odor of an old woman with wet eyes and, ordinarily at least, a dry pussy. She would not open this box and look at the wonder it contained in here. She would go outside, where the air was clean and the only smells were sage and mesquite. She would look by the light of the kissing moon. Rhea of Coos Hill pulled the box from its hole with a grunt, rose to her feet with another grunt, this one from her nether regions, tucked the box under her arm, and left the room. 2. The hut was far enough below the brow of the hill to block off the bitterest gusts of the winter wind, which blew almost constantly in these highlands from reaping until the end of wide earth. A path led to the hill's highest vantage. Beneath the full moon it was a ditch of silver. The old woman toiled up it, puffing, her white hair standing out around her head in dirty clumps, her old dug swaying from side to side under her black dress. The cat followed in her shadow, still giving off its rusty purr like a stink. At the top of the hill, the wind lifted her hair away from her ravaged face and brought her the moaning whisper of the thinny, which had eaten its way into the far end of Eyebolt Canyon. It was a sound few cared for, she knew, but she herself loved it. To Rhea of the Coos it sounded like a lullaby. Overhead rode the moon, the shadows on its bright skin sketching the faces of lovers kissing, if you believe the ordinary fools below, that was. The ordinary fools below saw a different face or set of faces in each full moon, but the hag knew there was only one, the face of the demon, the face of death. She herself, however, had never felt more alive. "Oh, my beauty," she whispered, and touched the lock with her gnarled fingers. A faint glimmer of red light showed between her bunched knuckles, and there was a click. Breathing hard, like a woman who has run a race, she put the box down and opened it. Rose-colored light, dimmer than that thrown by the kissing moon, but infinitely more beautiful, spilled out. It touched the ruined face hanging above the box, and for a moment made it the face of a young girl again. Musty sniffed, head stretched forward, ears laid back, old eyes rimmed with that rose light. Rhea was instantly jealous.
"Get away, foolish! 'Tis not for the likes of you."
She swatted the cat. Musty shied back, hissing like a kettle, and stalked in dudgeon to the hummock which marked the very tip of Coos Hill. There he sat, affecting disdain, and licking one paw as the wind combed ceaselessly through his fur. Within the box was a glass globe. It was filled with that rosy light. It flowed in gentle pulses, like the beat of a satisfied heart.
"Oh, my lovely one," she murmured, lifting it out.
She held it up before her, let its pulsing radiance run down her wrinkled face like rain.
"Oh, you live, so you do."
Suddenly the color within the globe darkened toward scarlet. She felt it thrum in her hands like an immensely powerful motor, and again she felt that amazing wetness between her legs, that tidal tug she believed had been left behind long ago. Then the thrumming died, and the light in the globe seemed to furl up like petals. Where it had been, there was now a pinkish gloom, and three riders coming out of it. At first she thought it was the men who had brought her the globe, Jonas and the others. But no, these were younger, even younger than DePape, who was about 25. The one on the left of the trio appeared to have a bird's skull mounted on the pommel of his saddle. Strange, but true. Then that one and the one on the right were gone, darkened away somehow by the power of the glass, leaving only the one in the middle. She took in the jeans and boots he wore, the flat-brimmed hat that hid the upper half of his face, the easy way he sat his horse. And her first alarmed thought was, gunslinger. Come east from the inner baronies, aye, perhaps from Gilead itself. But she did not have to see the upper half of the rider's face to know he was little more than a child, and there were no guns on his hips. Yet she didn't think the youth came unarmed. If only she could see a little better. She brought the glass almost to the tip of her nose and whispered, "Closer, lovey, closer still." She didn't know what to expect. Nothing at all seemed most likely. But within the dark circle of the glass, the figure did come closer. Swam closer, almost, like a horse and rider under water, and she saw there was a quiver of arrows on his back. Before him, on the pommel of his saddle, was not a skull but a short bow. And to the right side of the saddle, where a gunslinger might have carried a rifle in a scabbard, there was the feather-fluffed shaft of a lance. He was not one of the old people. His face had none of that look. Yet she did not think he was of the outer arc, either.
"But who are ye, Cully?" she breathed. "And how shall I know ye? You've got your hat pulled down so far I can't see your God-pounding eyes, so you do. By your horse, mayhap. Or perhaps by your... Get away, Musty. Why do you trouble me so? Arr!"
The cat had come back from its lookout point and was twining back and forth between her swollen old ankles, roaring up at her in a voice even more rusty than its purr. When the old woman kicked out at him, Musty dodged agilely away, then immediately came back and started in again, looking up at her with moonstruck eyes and making those soft yowls. Rhea kicked out at it again, this one just as ineffectual as the first one, then looked into the glass once more. The horse and its interesting young rider were gone. The rose light was gone as well. It was now just a dead glass ball she held, its only light a reflection borrowed from the moon. The wind gusted, pressing her dress against the ruination that was her body. Musty, undaunted by the feeble kicks of his mistress, darted forward and began to twine about her ankles again, crying up at her the whole time.
"There, do you see what you've done, you nasty bag of fleas and disease? The light's gone out of it, gone out just when I..."
Then she heard a sound from the cart track which led up to her hut, and understood why Musty had been acting out. It was singing she heard. It was the girl she heard. The girl was early. Grimacing horribly, she loathed being caught by surprise, and the little miss down there would pay for doing it. She bent and put the glass back in its box. The inside was lined with padded silk, and the ball fit as neatly as the breakfast egg in his lordship's cup. And still from down the hill, the cursed wind was wrong, or she would have heard it sooner, the sound of the girl singing, now closer than ever.
"Love, oh love, oh careless love, can't you see what careless love has done?"
"I'll give 'ee careless love, you virgin bitch," the old woman said.
She could smell the sour reek of sweat from under her arms, but that other moisture had dried up again.
"I'll give you payday for walking in early on old Rhea, so I will."
She passed her fingers over the lock on the front of the box, but it wouldn't fasten. She supposed she had been over-eager to have it open, and had broken something inside it when she used the touch. The eye and the motto seemed to mock her, "I see who opens me." It could be put right and in a jiffy, but right now even a jiffy was more than she had.
"Pestering cunt," she whined, lifting her head briefly toward the approaching voice,
almost here now by the gods, and 45 minutes before her time. Then she closed the lid of the box. It gave her a pang to do it, because the glass was coming to life again, filling with that rosy glow, but there was no time for looking or dreaming now. Later, perhaps, after the object of Thorin's unseemly late-life prickishness had gone.
"And you must restrain yourself from doing anything too awful to the girl,"
she cautioned herself.
"Remember, she's here because of him, and at least ain't one of those green girls with a bun in the oven and a boyfriend acting reluctant about the cries of marriage. It's Thorin's doing. This one's what he thinks about after his ugly old crow of a wife is asleep and he takes himself in his hand and commences the evening milking. It's Thorin's doing. He has the old law on his side, and he has power. Furthermore, what's in that box is his man's business, and if Jonas found out she looked at it, that she used it...
Aye, but no fear of that. And in the meantime, possession were 9/10 of the law, were it not? She hoisted the box under one arm, hoisted her skirts with her free hand, and ran back along the path to the hut. She could still run when she had to, aye, though few there were who'd believe it. Musty ran at her heels, bounding along with his cloven tail held high and his extra legs flopping up and down in the moonlight. Chapter 2 Proving Honesty 1 Rhea darted into her hut, crossed in front of the guttering fire, then stood in the doorway to her tiny bedroom, swiping a hand through her hair in a distracted gesture. The bitch hadn't seen her outside the hut. She surely would have stopped caterwauling, or at least faltered in it if she had, and that was good. But the cursed hidey-hole had sealed itself up again, and that was bad. There was no time to open it again, either. Rhea hurried to the bed, knelt, and pushed the box far back into the shadows beneath. Aye, that would do. Until Susie Greengown was gone, it would do very well. Smiling on the right side of her mouth, the left was mostly frozen, Rhea got up, brushed her dress, and went to meet her second appointment of the night. 2. Behind her, the unlocked lid of the box clicked open. It came up less than an inch, but that was enough to allow a sliver of pulsing, rose-colored light to shine out. 3. Susan Delgado stopped about 40 yards from the witch's hut, the sweat chilling on her arms and the nape of her neck. Had she just spied an old woman, surely the one she had come to see, dart down that last bit of path leading from the top of the hill? She thought she had. Don't stop singing. When an old lady hurries like that, she doesn't want to be seen. If you stop singing, she'll likely know she was. For a moment, Susan thought she'd stop anyway, that her memory would close up like a startled hand and deny her another verse of the old song, which she had been singing since youngest childhood. But the next verse came to her, and she continued on, with feet as well as voice. Once my cares were far away, yes, once my cares were far away, now my love has gone from me, and misery is in my heart to stay. A bad song for a night such as this, mayhap, but her heart went its own way without much interest in what her head thought or wanted, always had. She was frightened to be out by moonlight when werewolves were said to walk. She was frightened of her errand, and she was frightened by what that errand portended. Yet when she had gained the great road out of Hambry, and her heart had demanded she run, she had run. Under the light of the kissing moon, and with her skirt held above her knees, she had galloped like a pony, with her shadow galloping right beside her. For a mile or more she had run, until every muscle in her body tingled, and the air she pulled down her throat tasted like some sweet, heated liquid. And when she reached the upland track leading to this high sinister, she had sung, because her heart demanded it. And, she supposed, it really hadn't been such a bad idea. If nothing else, it had kept the worst of her megrims away. Singing was good for that much, anyway. Now she walked to the end of the path, singing the chorus of Careless Love. As she stepped into the scant light which fell through the open door and onto the stoop, a harsh rain-crow voice spoke from the shadows.
"Stop your howling, missy. It catches in my brains like a fishhook."
Susan, who had been told all her life that she had a fair singing voice, a gift from her grandma, no doubt, fell silent at once, abashed. She stood on the stoop with her hands clasped in front of her apron. Beneath the apron, she wore her second-best dress. She only had two. Beneath it, her heart was thumping very hard. A cat, a hideous thing with two extra legs sticking out of its sides like toasting forks, came into the doorway first. It looked up at her, seemed to measure her, then screwed its face up in a look that was eerily human, contempt. It hissed at her, then flashed away into the night.
"Well, good evening to you, too," Susan thought.
The old woman she had been sent to see stepped into the doorway. She looked Susan up and down with that same expression of flat-eyed contempt, then stood back.
"Come in, and mind you clap the door tight. The wind has a way of blowing it open, as you see."
Susan stepped inside. She didn't want to close herself into this bad-smelling room with the old woman, but when there was no choice, hesitation was ever a fault. So her father had said, whether the matter under discussion was sums and subtractions, or how to deal with boys at barn dances when their hands became overly adventurous. She pulled the door firmly to and heard it latch.
"And here you are,"
the old woman said, and offered a grotesque smile of welcome. It was a smile guaranteed to make even a brave girl think of stories told in the nursery, winter's tales of old women with snaggled teeth and bubbling cauldrons full of toad-green liquid. There was no cauldron over the fire in this room, nor was the fire itself much of a shake, in Susan's opinion. But the girl guessed there had been, betimes, and things in it of which it might be better not to think. That this woman was a real witch and not just an old lady posing as one was something Susan had felt sure of from the moment she had seen Rhea darting back inside her hut with the malformed cat at her heels. It was something you could almost smell, like the reeky aroma rising off the hag's skin. "Yes," she said, smiling. She tried to make it a good one, bright and unafraid. "Here I am."
"And it's early yar, my little sweeting, early yar."
"I ran part way. The moon got into my blood, I suppose. That's what my dad would have said."
The old woman's horrible smile widened into something that made Susan think of the way eels sometimes seem to grin, after death and just before the pot.
"Aye, but dead he is, dead these 5 years, Pat Delgado of the red hair and beard, the life mashed out of him by his own horse, aye, and went into the clearing at the end of the path with the music of his own snapping bones in his ears, so he did."
The nervous smile slipped from Susan's face as if slapped away. She felt tears, always close at the mere mention of her dad's name, burn at the back of her eyes, but she would not let them fall, not in this heartless old crow's sight she wouldn't.
"Let our business be quick and be done,"
she said in a dry voice that was far from her usual one. That voice was usually cheery and merry and ready for fun. But she was Pat Delgado's child, daughter of the best drover ever to work the Western Drop, and she remembered his face very well. She could rise to a stronger nature if required, as it now clearly was. The old woman had meant to reach out and scratch as deep as she could, and the more she saw that her efforts were succeeding, the more she would redouble them. The hag, meanwhile, was watching Susan shrewdly, her bunch-knuckled hands planted on her hips while her cap twined around her ankles. Her eyes were rheumy, but Susan saw enough of them to realize they were the same gray-green shade as the cat's eyes, and to wonder what sort of fell magic that might be. She felt an urge, a strong one, to drop her eyes, and would not. It was all right to feel fear, but sometimes a very bad idea to show it.
"You look at me pert, missy,"
Rhea said at last. Her smile was dissolving slowly into a petulant frown.
"Nay, old mother," Susan replied evenly, "only as one who wishes to do the business she came for and be gone. I have come here at the wish of my Lord Mayor of Magus, and at that of my Aunt Cordelia, sister of my father, my dear father, of whom I would hear no ill spoken."
"I speak as I do," the old woman said.
The words were dismissive, yet there was a trace of fawning servility in the hag's voice. Susan set no importance on that, It was a tone such a thing as this had probably adopted her whole life and came as automatically as breath.
"I've lived alone a long time, with no mistress but myself, and once it begins, my tongue goes where it will."
"Then sometimes it might be best not to let it begin at all." The old woman's eyes flashed uglily.
"Curb your own, stripling girl, lest you find it dead in your mouth, where it will rot and make the mayor think twice about kissing you when he smells its stink. Aye, even under such a moon as this."
Susan's heart filled with misery and bewilderment. She'd come up here intent on only one thing, getting the business done as quickly as possible, a barely explained rite that was apt to be painful and sure to be shameful. Now this old woman was looking at her with flat and naked hatred. How could things have gone wrong with such suddenness? Or was it always this way with witches?
"We have begun badly, mistress. Can we start over?"
Susan asked suddenly, and held out her hand. The hag looked startled, although she did reach out and make brief contact, the wrinkled tips of her fingers touching the short-nailed fingers of the 16-year-old girl who stood before her, with her clear-skinned face shining and her long hair braided down her back. Susan had to make a real effort not to grimace at the touch, brief as it was. The old woman's fingers were as chilly as those of a corpse. But Susan had touched chilly fingers before. "Cold hands, warm heart," Aunt Cord sometimes said. The real unpleasantness was in the texture, the feel of cold flesh, spongy and loose on the bones, as if the woman to whom they were attached had drowned and lain long in some pool.
Nay, there's no starting over," the old woman said. "Yet mayhap we'll go on better than we've begun. You've a powerful friend in the mayor, and I'd not have him for my enemy."
She's honest, at least, Susan thought, then had to laugh at herself. This woman would be honest only when she absolutely had to be. Left to her own devices and desires, she'd lie about everything, the weather, the crops, the flights of birds come reaping.
"He came before I expected ye, and it's put me out of temper, so it has. Have ye brought me something, missy? Ye have, I'll warrant."
Her eyes were glittering once more, this time not with anger. Susan reached beneath her apron, so stupid, wearing an apron for an errand on the backside of nowhere, but it was what custom demanded, and into her pocket. There, tied to a string so it could not be easily lost, by a young girl suddenly moved to run in the moonlight, perchance, was a cloth bag. Susan broke the binding string and brought the bag out. She put it in the outstretched hand before her, the palm so worn that the lines marking it were now little more than ghosts. She was careful not to touch Rhea again, although the old woman would be touching her again, and soon.
"Is it the sound of the wind makes ye shiver?"
Rhea asked. Although Susan could tell her mind was mostly fixed on the little bag, her fingers were busy tugging out the knot in the drawstring.
"Yes, the wind."
"And so it should. 'Tis the voices of the dead you hear in the wind, and when they scream so, 'tis because they regret—ah!"
The knot gave. She loosened the drawstring and tumbled 2 gold coins into her hand. They were unevenly milled and crude, no one had made such for generations, but they were heavy, and the eagles engraved upon them had a certain power. Rhea lifted one to her mouth, pulled back her lips to reveal a few gruesome teeth, and bit down. The hag looked at the faint indentations her teeth had left in the gold. For several seconds she gazed, rapt, then closed her fingers over them tightly. While Rhea's attention was distracted by the coins, Susan happened to look through the open door to her left and into what she assumed was the witch's bedchamber. And here she saw an odd and disquieting thing, a light under the bed, a pink, pulsing light. It seemed to be coming from some kind of box, although she could not quite... The witch looked up, and Susan hastily moved her eyes to a corner of the room, where a net containing 3 or 4 strange white fruits hung from a hook. Then, as the old woman moved and her huge shadow danced ponderously away from that part of the wall, Susan saw they were not fruits at all, but skulls. She felt a sickish drop in her stomach.
"The fryer needs building up, missy. Go around to the side of the house and bring back an armload of wood. Good-sized sticks are what's wanted, and never mind whining, you can't lug 'em. You're of a strapping good size, so you are."
Susan, who had quit whining about chores around the time she had quit pissing into her clouts, said nothing, although it did cross her mind to ask Rhea if everyone who brought her gold was invited to lug her wood. In truth, she didn't mind. The air outside would taste like wine after the stench of the hut. She had almost reached the door when her foot struck something hot and yielding. The cat yowled. Susan stumbled and almost fell. From behind her, the old woman issued a series of gasping, choking sounds, which Susan eventually recognized as laughter.
"Watch Musty, my little sweet one. Tricksy he is, and tripsy as well, betimes, so he is.
And off she went in another gale. The cat looked up at Susan, its ears laid back, its gray-green eyes wide. It hissed at her. And Susan, unaware she was going to do it until it was done, hissed back. Like its expression of contempt, Musty's look of surprise was eerily, and in this case comically, human. It turned and fled for Rhea's bedroom, its split tail lashing. Susan opened the door and went outside to get the wood. Already she felt as if she had been here 1,000 years.